Good evening, friends. I trust you are all prepared this evening to join with me in taking a journey. A journey which is indeed the human journey as we seek to transform ourselves and to become, in the process, I trust, more human in a world which desperately needs human, truly human beings. In many of the esoteric traditions of the world, it has been said that to obtain life in human form is the greatest privilege. Now, what is meant by this? The challenge is simply that we need to understand what it means to be human. Not just to be in a physical form, but to be human through and through. The challenge is to preserve this condition by acting at all times in a manner that is human. Indeed, today, our humanity is threatened not simply by forces that are external to our nature, but really everything that threatens us arises from within ourselves. We have ourselves created the circumstances which today appear to threaten us from without. Much has been said and written, of course, about the dehumanization of man by the technological devices that we ourselves have created. And many voices today are being raised in a kind of protest against a view of man that would remove his essential humanity, his essential human identity, by categorizing him as an animal, albeit as a superior one, among other animals, or as a machine, although a very complicated and skillful machine, among other machines. So I suggest that the preservation, as well as the discovery, of our human nature is no easy task. One writer has pointed out, in fact, that every generation has the definition of man that it deserves. And our generation may well have moved from the Aristotelian perspective of the scholastic philosophy of the Middle Ages, which defined man as a rational being, an animal with a capacity for choice. But in our contemporary world, we are all too often prone to identify ourselves in the image of a machine. And evidence of our contemporary situation, I think, often lies in the fact that when we frame the question concerning our identity, and this is very often true when it is discussed by theologians, by philosophers, by scientists, and even in our theosophical branches, in the presentation of that ageless wisdom known as theosophy, we frame the question, what is man? And this whatness places us then in the category of things, one thing among other things. But rather, I suggest, we need to frame our question in terms of who is man. For it is this who-ness that defines the humanity as the humanity within us as a process in which we are constantly engaged, a journey in which we are embarked, a journey on which our quest is always for knowing more, for feeling more, and ultimately for that interior transformation that carries us beyond ourselves. It is a journey in which, indeed, the very process of traveling is not in itself distinct from the unfolding awareness of our own mystery. For even in the discovery of ourselves, we only plunge further into the mysterious depths of being. An ancient scripture has put it so beautifully, "Thou canst not travel on that path before thou hast become the path itself." Being human is a process, a journey in which we are all engaged together. What then constitutes a human incarnation, and how is it to be preserved? The great Buddhist reformer of the late 14th and early 15th centuries, Tsongkhapa, set forth far before modern contemporary psychology, set forth the conditions required for man to be considered human. And it is evident, I think, that he foreshadowed contemporary developments in psychological thought by his emphasis on stating that man's uniqueness arises out of a psychological order, out of a reference to the kinds of mental processes in which we engage, the choices, in other words, that we make. For our humanity is not then a random happening, an accident in a world of accidents, but rather it is the result of carefully nurtured attitudes, of actions founded on moral and ethical principles, and of continued efforts to live in a manner consonant with this interior human view of things. In other words, we are under an obligation to live and to act at all times in such a manner as to preserve and to advance our human status. The Western philosopher Immanuel Kant once said that the greatest concern of man is to know what one has to be in order to be a man. The truly human is really expressed in the power of choice. There is an old Hebrew saying to the effect that man was created for the sake of choice. And the sense of a choice of ways is one of the fundamental principles present in all the mythologies of the world. Not only, of course, must we face the consequences of our choices, but we must also recognize that no one else can make our choices for us. Others cannot make our choices. The art of living, in fact, is in the power of inward choice. And if we fail to exercise this power, if we somehow lessen this faculty of choice, which makes us human, we shorten the stature of our souls. The central lesson of the great Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita, I suggest, is not so much that Arjuna must act. And in that scripture, of course, there is the great dialogue, the great discourse between Arjuna, symbolic of every man, symbolic of every individual. Arjuna was simply a man with a problem. And that, after all, is what most of us who come here or who walk the world today, most of us are simply people with problems. And his great discourse was with his charioteer, the divine Sri Krishna, the immortal spirit in each one of us, which we may contact if we will but listen. The great lesson of the Bhagavad Gita is not so much that Arjuna must act, but rather that he must act out of his own choice. He must reach his own decision, and he must base that decision on an understanding of what action, true action, involves. So I suggest that our human journey, the journey which we are going to take together this evening, in some of its aspects at least, must begin with an understanding of who we are, and therefore what constitutes our humanness. H.P. Blavatsky, who in our time reintroduced into the Western world especially, but into the Eastern world as well, an appreciation for the ageless wisdom which we today refer to as theosophy, set forth a definition of man as a seven-leafed plant, a sapta parna, seven principles. The recognition that indeed many scientists are today coming to, that this is a valid hypothesis for understanding the human state, the human condition. And these seven principles can be very easily summarized in one sense as that immortal spirit, or Atman, if you prefer to call it, in union with the principle of universal perception, universal compassion, universal understanding, constituting a monad, operative in the field of the evolutionary development of all of our being. In other words, to make it extremely simple, we may look at man in his threefold nature, as St. Paul defined him, and into which this sevenfold system, very conveniently, if I may put it that way, can be fitted. That man is that being in the universe, in other words, in whom highest spirit and lowest matter are joined together by intelligence. Three factors, in other words, are involved in the who-ness of ourselves. Essentially, three factors, with the focus clearly today on the middle principle, the mind, the psychological nature, at which will become evident as we proceed. Here at this central point, the psychological nature is found both the agony and the glory of being human, uniting in ourselves highest spirit with an earthly physical incarnation. And here at the central point, the magnum opus of the human journey, to make conscious the supreme Godhood in our everyday existence. And so in considering the human journey, I think it may be useful to adopt a very simple classification, which I am simply referring to as spirit, soul, and body, to use the English terms. These can, of course, be translated and have been into the Trans-Himalayan system of Taraka Raja Yoga. They can be translated into the Gnostic system of St. Paul and the Gnostic schools, the Essene schools. But the very simplest way in the English is spirit, soul, and body. Now, the unique value of this system in the consideration of this journey on which I want to take us tonight becomes evident when we consider further that a fundamental principle of the esoteric philosophy, as it has been taught in all ages, from ancient India through Egypt and Greece and into modern times indeed, is that there is a triple evolutionary scheme. H.P. Blavatsky wrote of this in her magnum opus, The Secret Doctrine, that there exists in nature a triple evolutionary scheme for the formation of the three major vessels or vehicles or carriers of the universal spirit. Three schemes of evolution which in our system are inextricably interwoven and interblended at every point. These are, of course, the monadic or spiritual, the intellectual, and the physical evolution. And these each follow their own laws. Time, of course, does not permit a full examination of each one of these separate schemes of evolution, as it were, and the manner in which they interblend and are interwoven. Each of them is represented, as I say, in the constitution of man. But it is helpful if we can begin to see that the focus today is clearly at the psychological level. It is here that the battle for men's minds is being waged. It is here that we are being torn apart in that feeling, thinking area of our being, in the theosophical literature technically called the kama manasic element in our nature, in the recognition that here we are indeed suffering, and here indeed can we attain to our fullest glory. A decade or so ago, a biologist is reported to have announced, "I have discovered the missing link between the anthropoid apes and civilized men. It's us." Well, the theosophical student may well paraphrase such a statement by pointing to the occult view of man, in which the link between the animal state of existence in terms of a physical body and the immortal spirit or Atman is the psychological nature where we are today focused. Indeed, in us are met all of the opposites, and in man alone can come the resolution of the opposites. This is the human journey to which H.P. Blavatsky directed our attention nearly a century ago in emphasizing in connection with the fundamental propositions on which the occult or theosophical doctrine is based, that, and I quote from The Secret Doctrine, the pivotal doctrine of the esoteric philosophy admits no special privileges or gifts in man save those won by his own ego through personal effort and merit throughout a long series of metempsychoses and reincarnations. Now, relating this doctrine, this essential doctrine, to the threefold evolutionary stream in the production and development of that which is truly man, through which the one ultimate reality, localized as Atma, manifests itself, I suggest we may see that there are three primary processes involved. These may be termed, first of all, reincarnation, which is a marvelous subject to explore in itself, in which the developing consciousness sheathes itself in successive vehicles appropriate to the awakening life within. The second process in which we are involved, and to which reference was made in the quotation I have just read to you from The Secret Doctrine, is unfortunately one of the most misunderstood of all doctrines today, and that is the process known as metempsychosis, by which self-transformation is essentially meant, by which the psycho-mental constituents of man's constitution are shaped into the likeness of the archetypal or heavenly man. And this is the process at which I would like to look at this evening for the most part in this talk. The third process may be called that of enlightenment, by which the spiritual nature stands revealed in its full and awesome splendor. These processes are connected in every respect, and they relate actually to three kinds of time. And I think this is especially important for us today, as we are learning a great deal from science and from the scientific explorations of outer space, from physics and so on, that there are various kinds of time. And indeed, philosophically, this has always been known. Reincarnation takes place in linear time. It is sequential, in other words. And therefore, it is possible to speak of past incarnations and future existences, and to say of this current transitory existence, this current transitory complex that we call ourselves, this is my present incarnation. Metempsychosis, however, occurs in what has been called mythic time, the time of myth, the time that it deals with the hero journey of the soul, with a beginning that is possible at any moment of linear time. For one does not need to wait on a new incarnation. And how many of us would like to start all over again and say, well, I'll wait till next time and take it up. But we are dealing now with a process that can begin here, this moment, this immediate nowness, the mythic time that is always referred to in all fairy stories, once upon a time. Indeed, the great Jewish theologian Dr. Martin Buber proposed that the initial words of the Hebraic scripture should not be translated that in the beginning, but rather for the sake of a beginning, implying that at every moment God enters into the universe for the sake of a beginning with the awakening of any individual to the awareness of the possibility of his journey to his own perfected state of existence. The process of enlightenment, as the Buddha's experience clearly evidenced, takes place outside of time altogether. It is the now which always is, and which can enter the world of time at any point. In fact, the very word process can scarcely be applied to enlightenment. Well, it has become, I know, axiomatic to say that today man stands at the crossroads, and that upon his present decisions will rest not only his own survival, but the very survival of the earth on which we stand. There are those who are crying out that we have already chosen the fatal fork in the road, that we are well along the way to self-destruction and self-annihilation. Well, if that is so, then we must have the courage to retrace our steps, to return to the treacherous junction by facing the consequences of our old choices. Just another way of speaking of an ancient doctrine known as karma, and start off anew on the genuine road that leads to our goal. An African proverb reminds us that the road never says anything to anyone. Indeed, the road does not tell us, because we have to travel in order to know where we are going, as it were. Myth and fairy tale are replete with examples of those who took the wrong turnings, who found themselves, as did Christian in John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, in the slough of despond, and had to retrace their steps, living out the results of unhappy choices, until with renewed strength they could once more set out on the great journey. And all about us, there may be signs that we in our time have embarked on the wrong road. Sometimes I think we act very much like passengers in a bus, chattering away about our own petty concerns and the trivialities of existence, never looking out the window to see where we may be going, what is the terrain over which we may be traveling. Occasionally we may hear someone in a forward seat cry out, urging the driver to stop, to turn around, to take another direction. But we only laugh and say, There'll always be oil in the world. There's enough for us. There's enough food for us. There are enough resources for us. We don't need to worry in our own little sphere, on our own little islands. And I'm not speaking geographically, but I'm speaking figuratively. For each of us lives on our own little island. And so when we do finally wake up to the direction that we have been taking, when we become aware that the bus can be stopped and we ourselves can take a hand in determining our destination, then as all the great myths of the world relate, we begin in earnest to seek out the hero journey of the soul. And like Ulysses, in the poem describing his epic adventures by Tennyson, we set out to sail beyond the sunset and the baths of all the western stars. It may be that the gulfs will wash us down. It may be that we shall touch the happy isles. That which we are, we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. Well, our work then has been clearly, I think, set forth before us. Today there is no longer a choice. We must take up the human journey, the quest for self-transformation. The forces that are arrayed against us are no longer those that would enslave the body, but those that hold in bondage the minds and hearts of men. Forces we ourselves have set in motion through all the ages of our unconscious wanderings in the desert of ignorance. We must win through to our immortality, a lonely journey it may be, and yet we are never alone. For if we will but look, the signposts are clearly marked by generations of sages and seers, adept teachers and world saviors. We travel from the self to the immortal self, and on to the one self. Well, the process or method by which this journey, this interior journey, is accomplished is that known as metempsychosis, a doctrine so grossly misunderstood and misinterpreted that until it is viewed in the light of the esoteric philosophy, it makes very little understanding. The process of metamorphosis in certain organisms that undergo a complete internal change is really analogous to the task which must be undertaken in full self-conscious awareness by each individual for himself, the metempsychosis which we must undertake. Usually the word has been translated as changing soul after soul. But it is really that bringing about of a new consciousness, a doctrine which is fundamentally, of course, Platonic. And we may best understand it, therefore, in the light of Plato's concept of the soul. With metempsychosis, therefore, we begin to understand that the responsibility of the individual soul is emphasized, that we are responsible for ourselves. This is very difficult for us. How easy it would be to blame our parents, our partners, our children, circumstances, the educational system, the politics or government of a country, the economic situation, and so on. But in this doctrine, the responsibility of the individual soul is indeed emphasized. In one of the great dialogues of Plato, for example, the Phaedo, we are reminded that if the soul is really immortal, what care should be taken of her not only in respect of the portion of time which is called life, but of eternity. And the danger of neglecting her from this point of view does indeed appear to be awful. Essentially human within us. A complete analysis of the myths of Plato, as presented in so many of the great dialogues of Plato, would indicate that when Plato speaks of the souls of men as changing into the souls of animals, he does not mean this literally, but rather that this is the possibility of losing our humanness by living in such a manner, content only with the things of the body, without energizing the interior principles by the divine faculties, so that indeed we have become animalistic. When our souls, for example, are represented as falling in, as suffering a transmutation into brutes, it must be understood, indeed, as Proclus and the Neoplatonists pointed out, that it is only that a certain sympathy binds us to that on which we think and to that to which we give our allegiance. More explicitly, for example, Plato pointed out that such as are addicted to gluttony, arrogant injuries and drinking, and this without any fear of consequences, shall enter into the tribes of asses and brutes. And interestingly enough, those who remained human were, of course, the philosophers, those who thought about spiritual matters and whose concerns were with the human quality within. Now, one may even note the nearly unconscious continuation of such a view in terms of the language that we use to describe individuals. How often we describe people by vegetable and animal traits. We may say, for example, that a woman addicted to gossip is catty, that a man who pursues women is a wolf. Language, indeed, preserves mythological truths and reflects great principles. Though the basis for certain expressions may long since have been forgotten, but in the present context, we begin to recognize that we tend to maintain in our speech the essential significance of this doctrine of metempsychosis, even when we may intellectually reject its usual exoteric connotations. Now, the ease with which the human state can be lost is nowhere better illustrated than in a very dramatic account of metempsychosis, which has been preserved to us from the 2nd century AD by the brilliant adherent of the Neoplatonic school, Lucius Apuleius. This is the work which is known as the Transformations of Lucius, otherwise called the Golden Ass. And, of course, Lucius was, if I may put it this way, not the first to become an ass over psychic phenomena. And there are still individuals in the world today who are losing their heads or wearing asses' heads as a result of the same kind of inquisitiveness, as you will see. It is impossible to relate all of the story. It's a marvelous work which has been preserved to us and translated in our time by the eminent British poet Robert Graves. Whatever the reason, however, for the survival of this work, its significance, particularly in its present relevance to our understanding of the human journey, is indeed remarkable. The story that Apuleius relates is much intermixed, of course, with extraneous elements which certainly form blinds to the essential meaningfulness of the tale, as indeed genuine occultism has always been veiled in allegory and symbol, since its ultimate secrets are communicable only to those whose inner awareness and spiritual faculties permit such perception. But in the Golden Ass, we have the story of a young man, Lucius, whose name, interestingly enough, means light, who sets out on a journey to his mother's home. A very apt symbol, indeed, of the abode of Sophia, the eternal wisdom. In other words, it is a journey to that self-transformation which comes about by contacting the eternal wisdom itself. En route, Lucius encounters numerous experiences, adventures. He meets with people in all stations in life, and the novel is interspersed with fascinating tales that sometimes amuse, sometimes instruct, and occasionally even disgust the reader. The pattern of the book is very much like that adopted later by Boccaccio for the Decameron and Chaucer for Canterbury Tales, with which many of you, I'm sure, if not all of you, must be familiar. Well, in the course of his journey, Lucius meets a young and very attractive girl by the name of Fotis. You see, even in the second century AD, a romantic element had to be introduced very early on, and naturally he meets a young and lovely girl. Her name, Fotis, also means light, but it is reflected light. For the word, the Greek word photos, gives us our word photography and deals, therefore, with that realm of our being which is the reflection of the real, the emotional or astral realm of our being, which indeed is so beguiling to many and which often is mistaken for the real. It is through her that he is transformed into an ass, able now only to say hee-haw, because he has become glamorized by the magic which she says she can perform. It seems to be light that leads light astray. And yet it is the light, as I say, which is the reflected light of the astral world, the emotional, the comma realm of the passions and emotions. So the tragedy of the loss of our essential humaneness is often confounded when we realize the extent to which we ourselves make fools or asses of ourselves. When we identify ourselves with our emotional or instinctual natures. Now, the light that Fotis represents, therefore, is the illusory reflected light. In that remarkable work translated by H.P. Blavatsky, The Voice of the Silence, we are reminded to beware lest dazzled by elusive radiance thy soul should linger and be caught in its deceptive light. And indeed it is this which did bewitch Lucius, because Lucius was told by Fotis that she could give him an ointment that would make him all wise, all beautiful. And of course what happened when she applied the ointment, he became the ass. The number of people today, young and old, who are blinded by the dazzling light of the pseudo-occult, by promises of quickly acquired psychic abilities, or by their own search for self-gratification, is legion. And like Lucius, they may indeed, quite figuratively, if not literally, wear asses' heads as a result of their bewitchment. Lucius, I suggest, is but one figure in an ancient line of personified principles, the man of all ages, the individual human in his quest for wholeness, who thinks it can be achieved by one easy application of some divine ointment. Now the question then arises as to the means by which metempsychosis is effected and how the transformations occur that then lead to liberation and the ultimate goal of the process. This is essentially one question. And we find with Lucius that he had to, the only way in which he could recover his human condition was to eat roses, a marvelous symbol of the necessity for each of us to sacrifice and to eat to the full of the sacrifice of ourselves to ourselves. And it's very interesting to follow the story, because he's put out first in a stable where asses, of course, belong. And there he sees a small statue of the god to the horses. And around the statue are some roses. And naturally, he tries to reach for these. But he is beaten back, because liberation never comes that easily, never comes that swiftly. Well, I can let you in on the secret that by the end of the book, he has finally found the way to recover his lost identity, and he eats of the roses in the proper way. But we are dealing now with the means by which this change within is effected, how the transformations occur, and the ultimate goal. This fact has always been recognized in the true mysteries. And as I say, in the story of the golden ass, the story of Lucius, it is beautifully portrayed in his awakening to the effort that is required to achieve his own liberation. Because it is always through personal effort and merit that we proceed on our human journey that leads to the final transcendence of the human condition. Indeed, at the end of the story, Lucius had to break through a crowd of people pressing about him, a marvelous symbol of the need for every individual to stand on his own feet, to move out of the collective consciousness, as it were, from the standards of the masses and a crowd morality. And only then could he snatch at the garland of roses and eat them, as the work says, with loving relish. And so it is that each one of us must stand for himself, free from the crowd, pursue our own lonely inner experience, unprotected and yet also undisturbed, and eat to the full of the rose, symbol of sacrifice and love. The symbolism of the human journey, as recorded in the work of Apuleius, could be pursued very much further. But we may note here only that following the eating of the roses, which concluded the period of his punishment and torment, he underwent, as do all true initiates, the symbolic death and transfiguration, essential features of the genuine occult initiatory rites. Lucius' own words describe the experience beautifully. For he writes at the end, as he is initiated into the mysteries of Isis, "I approached the very gates of death and set one foot on Proserpine's threshold. At midnight I saw the sun shining as if it were noon. The curtains were pulled aside, and I was suddenly exposed, as when a statue is unveiled, dressed like the sun." Indeed, the culmination of Lucius' transformative process is reminiscent of the description of transfiguration given in that beautiful little work of theosophical wisdom, The Voice of the Silence. "He standeth now like a white pillar to the west, upon whose face the rising sun of thought eternal poureth forth its first most glorious waves. His mind, like a becalmed and boundless ocean, spreadeth out in shoreless space. He holdeth life and death in his strong hand." Indeed, my friends, these descriptions are but an evidence of that which we shall be in what I have often chosen to call the process that we may undertake to remember, No, not remember the past, but our human journey is to remember the future. And this is the great human journey, to remember that which we shall be, to put it together again, to let go of the past, to lay aside the ass's heads we've worn for so long, to forget the beguilement of the psychic faculties, the psychic glamour, and to remember the future splendor into which we shall one day break forth. The method by which the process of metempsychosis, of inner soul transformation is accomplished, has been variously defined. In the Neoplatonic literature and the early Theosophic literature, that is the literature of the 3rd and 4th centuries, it was referred to as the process of theurgy, to which H.P. Blavatsky refers in The Key to Theosophy, a very old term, the mystic belief that by returning to one's pristine purity of nature, man could move the gods to impart to him the divine mysteries. So whether known as yoga in the East or alchemy in the Western tradition, the theurgical task is still before us if we would win our immortality. In today's psychological terminology, it may be called self-actualization, individuation, or liberation. Whatever the name assigned to the human opus, we are dealing directly with the psychomental transformations which constitute the hero journey of the soul. The language of medieval alchemy, of course, provides a rich vocabulary for understanding the process itself. For what is required of us is a genuine inner metempsychosis, a second inner birth, the authentic regeneration, which is the production of the diamond body of Eastern alchemy, the spiritual gold or noble tincture of the Western alchemists. The process is a dynamic one. It is a work in every meaning of that word. And in today's world, therefore, where I think one of the major industries has become guru production, the concept of meditation has been so cheapened by the marketability of gadgets offering consciousness-altering mechanisms which demand of their users no personal effort whatsoever, we may overlook this age-old truth that he who would win through to his liberation cannot escape the labor required for the process. In our scientifically sophisticated age, of course, we are inclined to dismiss as superstition and fanciful imaginings the recipes and formulae of the medieval alchemists. But fortunately, in many schools of modern psychology, and most notably in the Jungian school of psychology, there is today a reawakening of the recognition that these mysterious formulae actually pointed to psychological processes which must take place, and that they use a terminology which is the symbolic language of essentially psychic and spiritual processes. In all alchemical texts, for example, certain basic motifs appear, according to which the lapis philosophorum, the philosopher's stone, the perfect and incorrupt substance, the latent goldness, is produced. Generally, the stages in transmutation are given as threefold, symbolized by the colors black, white, and red or gold. In some texts, there are four stages indicated: blackening, whitening, yellowing, and reddening. And into the alchemical vessel, then, which is man himself, there must be put the sulfur and salt. Sulfur symbolizing the desire nature, and salt symbolizing the seasoning by the rational mind, the faculty of the lower mind. And so we have a tremendous symbolism that here within the vessel of our own personality, the vessel of incarnation, the alchemical retort, is indeed all of the desire nature with its passions and appetites, seasoned with intellectual salt, and always a mystic agent then present, Mercury, or spirit in its most mystic sense, the wise who know that it is this that can transform the sulfur and salt ultimately into the principle of goldness. And so the work proceeds, a work which first seems to produce a blackness, which indeed is merely a stage in which we recognize the imperfections of our present nature and undergo a certain purification through darkness and misery, through conflict, through suffering. The lower nature is gradually being dissolved, a way which is pointed out in the yogic literature of Eastern alchemy as bringing about a realization of all from which we must detach ourselves, separate ourselves, wash it out of our being, as it were. Illusions about ourselves and the world gradually fall apart, and one confronts directly in what is known as the psychological terms as the shadow, or in alchemical terms, the black beast. We have to look at ourselves and recognize ourselves. Purge, as one ancient alchemist put it, purge the horrible darkness of our mind. Light a light for our senses. This stage is often felt indeed as a kind of melancholia, when even one's most cherished ideals and convictions seem hollow, and the entire work seems almost too difficult to attempt. And yet we have to confront even the darkest corners of our being. For if the world is dark and forbidding, it is because our vision has been obscure, because within us is the opaqueness and the shadow. And we cannot proceed to that transmutation of our condition which marks the necessary metempsychosis until we have confronted all that is dark and transformed it into all that is light. And so we must press onward, for if we persevere, we may be certain that even in the blackest hour, at the deepest point of suffering, the content of the next stage will appear. When the personality is emptied of all its dross and appears to be white, the stage known alchemically as whiteness, or the state of luna or silver, when the personality is inwardly translucent, shining with a reflected light of the true self. But the dangers of mistaking this stage as the ultimate in our journey can be great indeed. The Voice of the Silence, for example, refers very clearly to the danger of lingering in this second hall, the second of the three halls through which the aspirant must pass. Beware lest, dazzled by elusive radiance, thy soul should linger and be caught in its deceptive light. And so we must press onward on our journey to the final stage, the fusion of the human and the divine, the union of the personality with the essential self. Now the retort can be opened to reveal the philosopher's stone, the pure gold of wisdom, the diamond body, the Gnostic anthropos. By whatever name it has been called, there now stands forth the Savior of the world, the divine original man, long buried and forgotten, in the very center of our being. Dr. Carl Jung has quoted the 17th century alchemist Gerhard Dorn, "Transform yourselves from dead stones into living philosophical stones." And this is indeed the process to transform ourselves. While yet in physical incarnation, we are not going somewhere. We are here doing it, here in incarnation. Indeed, what began as a lonely way to oneself is found to be, in the end, a glorious path trod in the company of the gods. As another 17th century alchemist put it, "There is in our chemistry a certain noble substance over whose beginning affliction rules with vinegar, but over whose end joy rules with mirth. Therefore I have supposed that the same will happen to me, namely that I shall suffer difficulty, grief, and weariness at first, but in the end shall come to glimpse pleasanter and easier things." This, my friends, is our journey. The divine alchemy of individual transformation brings about ultimately the transformation of the world. For as we are transformed, as our vision changes, so we see the world in a new way. How is there then any other way than to undertake this human journey? How else can we change the world if we refuse to change ourselves? If we are in darkness, the world cannot know peace. "Learn to suffer," is the admonition given in the apocryphal Acts of John. Learn to suffer and you shall understand how not to suffer. Within ourselves, within you and me, are met all of the possibilities, both for world destruction and for world redemption. When we know how to bear the pain and burden of the world's sorrow, we shall know how to transmute that sorrow into supreme joy. "Thou art enlightened, choose thy way," is the ancient command. Nowhere, of course, has the human journey been more aptly summarized or more surely delineated than in the ancient Upanishadic verse, "From the unreal, lead me to the real. From darkness, lead me to light. From death, lead me to immortality." Here is, my friends, the age-old way, in accordance with the pivotal doctrine of the esoteric philosophy, taught in all ages and in all climes, in all places, under many names, and today represented to the world as that ageless tradition which is finding its way surely and slowly into the consciousness of humanity, awakening each one of us, awakening mankind to a recognition that we can be human. To be human is to care. To be human is to be vulnerable to all the life about us. To be human is to love, to smile, to walk with a lift, to hold our heads high. For if indeed we have learned to fly in the air like birds and to swim in the oceans like fish, it is time now that we learn to walk the earth like men. The way is there, the way that admits no privileges or special gifts in man, save those we have won by our own experience, a way in which we must realize ultimately that there is no one to lead us and no one to be led and nowhere to be led. For even here, even now, reality, light, immortality are all about us. And within us, we have but to open our eyes to see. The passage that is the human journey is worn by our own efforts through numberless external existences and countless inner transformations. And when we have won through, when we have become truly human, we shall see the real embedded in the unreal. We shall behold the light in all that is dark, and we shall know our own immortality in every transient moment of time. And one day in that mythic time of ever-nowness, when we have remembered the future that is ours, will come the climax of our journey, so beautifully described in the voice of the silence. Behold the mellow light that floods the eastern sky in signs of praise, both heaven and earth.